This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Raymond Merritt. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And today is August 15th, 2003. Mr. Merritt, you are in Marysville, California. And it is approximately 10:14 a.m. Central Standard Time. Sir, let's start with some biographical information on yourself. Could you tell us where you were born, when you were born, and a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Portland, Oregon, in 7 October 1929. Mm-hmm. As a youngster, of course, that was the start of the Depression area. I lived there about 4 years. My father worked for a furniture store in downtown Portland.
Mm-hmm.
The Depression, I had a younger brother born in 33. About that time, of course, with the Depression, things got a little rough. So family had an opportunity to find employment in Southern California, the Los Angeles area. So mm-hmm. the family moved to the Los Angeles area.
Okay.
Where my father did work.
What did he do there?
He worked for a large furniture, downtown furniture corporation, company that, but he was actually a drapery estimator. He estimated what it would cost people to put draperies and curtains and things like that and
okay.
design, special design, those kind of things.
Okay.
Part of his need to make ends meet, of course, during that time frame, he had a brother-in-law who was active in the California National Guard, so my father got involved with that type of thing. And as we progressed through the 30s, he progressed in rank in the Guard and in his position in the store.
Mm-hmm.
The National Guard was called active duty. The California National Guard was called active duty in 1940, so we spent some time up in Central California on the coast. Camp Roberts is what it was called in those days, or Camp San Luis Obispo, I'm sorry, in those days for a year, and then they were all released, and so we moved back to the Los Angeles area. And then 41, with the start of the war, he was called active duty again. So mm-hmm. when he was off to the military, we remained in the Los Angeles area.
Okay. How many siblings did you have?
Two.
Okay.
Another one was born in 1942.
So you were the oldest of the three?
I'm the oldest of three boys.
Okay. Did your mother work?
Off and on, yes. She at times... worked in a restaurant just as a waitress. Other times, I can remember she worked at what they call C's candy store retail.
Okay.
Candy.
That's a nice place for a mother
to
work.
For kids, huh?
Absolutely. So what are your remembrances of the Depression?
Very little. Honestly, don't recall that much about it. I know... there was not a lot of money going around
mm-hmm.
For a lot of extra things, but we had a good, good, healthy growing up when I was young.
Okay. What kind of jobs did you work as a young boy?
Probably starting about early 40s. I delivered newspapers in the morning for both one. Following the other, the large Los Angeles morning newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into high school, one of the things, my father was eventually stationed at Santa Anita Racetrack,
mm-hmm.
which is in Arcadia, California, and so we moved out in that area where I had and eventually started in and went to Alhambra High School.
Okay.
During that time frame, I worked in gas stations as that's when people, you went into the gas station and people, you were served your gas.
Right.
It wasn't self-service in those
right.
days. Then I worked in a lumber yard for a while just
mm-hmm.
as a handyman, and I worked odd jobs off and on my entire time I was going to high school
mm-hmm.
and even into junior college.
What kind of student were you?
Not not an outstanding student. I had a fair medal in grades.
Mm-hmm. What were your favorite subjects?
Engineering and drawing, mechanical type subjects. I eventually wound up going to Pasadena City College after I graduated from Alhambra High School in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Pasadena City College at that time and was involved in the program. It was really a technical program, aircraft detailed design work. It wasn't it was a termination course, a 2-year course, where you were prepared to go into aircraft industry and be a detailed designer for parts for airplanes at one of the factories.
Okay.
One of the summer times, the professor had head of that little department had great knowledge of the aircraft industries in Southern California, so he did get us jobs during the summertime. I worked for Northrop Aircraft.
Okay.
Not as a designer, but as a aircraft assembly.
Okay. Had you always been interested in airplanes?
Oh, yeah. I've been interested in airplanes all my life.
Mm-hmm.
As a youngster, making little flying models.
How did that start?
Oh, I don't. Maybe from the fact that when my next youngest brother was born in 33,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I think my father did to I don't want to pacify me, but to make me feel that I'm not being left out.
Yes,
all
sir.
Of a sudden, after we visited my mother and him in the hospital, after he was born, he took me downtown Portland, and we went on an airplane ride.
Huh.
And I will always remember that.
Mm-hmm.
2-seat, open cockpit, biplane.
Oh, wow.
And, just, you know, it interested me in aviation. I was involved with models, airplanes, and things as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts and memories about World War II?
I guess, you know, as a youngster, in the early teens, I remembered going on, certainly, and of course my father was gone, and he never did go overseas.
Okay.
But I did have relatives that were overseas and involved in the fighting, and you know, we were just, I think the basic tenet of most of Americans that I do, let's get the Japs beat and get on with the war, and get the Germans beat and come home and end it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get back to normal.
Okay. And as a young boy there in growing up on the West Coast, was there a fear of a Japanese invasion? Do you remember anything like that?
I don't recall that. I remember when shortly after we moved away from when we were up in the San Luis, north of San Luis Obispo, where my dad was that first year, there was an attack on the coast, and a ship sunk right off the beach where we lived by a Japanese submarine, but I don't think we were too concerned about it, you know.
Okay. So your interest in airplanes started with that airplane ride.
I surely would say that, yeah.
Okay.
And while I was in high school, by the time I was maybe 16, I did start take flying lessons.
Okay.
And by the time I was 16, I was qualified, I was ready to get a pilot's license.
Wow. What was it like for you to fly?
Oh, it's a marvelous feeling. The freedom that you have and the quiet, relatively, you know, pointing it where you want to go and go there, so to speak. Of course, light airplanes a little bit different than a high-powered jet aircraft. But you know, I've been involved with airplanes and flying as long as I can remember, basically.
Right. Did you have your eyes set on the service, or were you, you know, after you finished Pasadena City College, were you looking at actually going into business doing that, the aircraft design?
Basically, yes. I was going. My goal was going to industry.
Okay.
As I have mentioned, I was in the Navy Reserve from just after I got out of high school. I think a friend of mine went into that on a lark. Certainly in 1947, there was no war going on.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one of the Naval Reserve organizations was having a summer cruise. One of their ploys to get involved, get you involved, was a summer cruise through the Panama Canal. One of those 2-week things through the Panama Canal.
Right.
Sounded like a neat idea at the time. So my friend and I joined the Naval Reserve, and we did that, and we just stayed active in the Naval Reserve. You sign up for a commitment. But another thing that I tried to do when I got out of high school was to get involved in the flying end of the military.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down and took the necessary examinations, physical and mental, for going into the Navy, what they called at that time the V-5 program. It was a program that allowed young people to go into the Navy. They would, if you qualified, they would send you then 2 years to college at expense of the Navy. They would then take you out of college. You would go to flying school. You would become, if you graduated from that, you became a midshipman. You spent 2 years active duty flying, and then you went back to college for 2 years to get a degree where you were commissioned.
Okay.
And that was done to me at that time was a process where I could get a college education at no cost.
Right.
And, of course, I enjoyed the flying end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't, the first physical, I didn't qualify one reason or another, and so the Navy doctor gave me some, it was my eyesight, gave me some exercises to do, so and he said, come back in a year and we'll retest you and maybe you'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I did all of this, and a year later I went back to take the physical examination. I passed everything, but as they said, unfortunately, that program has stopped.
Oh, really?
The Navy V-5 program. It's, of course, the war had ended. This is now 48. The war had ended. Been over, and there's an excess of pilots and or not needed at that time. And I said, well, okay, thank you very much. I was in the Navy Reserve as a just enlisted seaman.
Mm-hmm.
So after I was found that the Navy program had ended so I could fly airplanes, I walked down the street and popped into the Air Force recruiter.
Right.
And I said, hey, what's the chances? And he says, sign the dotted line, you know. So I took all the physicals and passed that and was accepted as an aviation cadet.
Okay.
They don't have that program anymore, but it allowed you to go through flying school without a college degree. But since I did not have any college at that time, well, I was going to junior college, but I didn't have a degree, they said, you know, my name's toward the bottom of the list.
Mm-hmm.
So if you continue college, your name works up. So every time you get to finish a course, you let us know, and we'll move your name up on the list, which I was doing dutifully. 1950, I graduated from Pasadena City College with a AA degree, except in June. As you might recall, about June, July, August time frame, the Vietnam War started. Korean War started.
Yes, sir.
And then right then there happened to, and I'm still in this waiting list to go into the Air Force as a pilot trainee, aviation cadet. I think I graduated from junior college, and about 3 weeks later, there was a notice in my mail, report to class in in Perrin, Texas,
right.
in August of 1950, so I was on my way.
Okay. And that's when you really started your Air Force training?
Yes, that was that was the aviation cadet program.
And how did your family feel about you going off and the war having just started?
Well, I think being part of a military family, that was, that's what I wanted to do, so they were all in favor of that. They knew I liked to fly. They knew I had interest in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I was married at that time.
Okay.
I had gotten married right after I finished junior college.
Okay.
That was a little difficult for her to go off and leave a wife after being married for 2 months.
But yes, sir.
I think the understanding, well, she had known me for quite a while. We had known each other for quite a while, so she knew what was going on with that in respect to what I wanted to do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And, so she honored that, and we did separate there for a while.
Okay. Tell me about your training at Perrin. What was it like for you?
Oh, it was a real joy to get into something that had some, flying an airplane that had some power. T-6 airplanes is what we flew with here at Perrin. I don't even know how many hours we were required to get. But it was the basic training, what they called at that time basic training, was a six-month time frame at that pace. And you went through all the necessary steps to learn to fly and operate the T-6.
Now, you already knew. You had a leg up, I guess, because you...
Well, I could fly. That was, you know, that wasn't the problem. It's just transitioning something a tad bit heavier.
And yes, sir.
I don't know that that put me at an advantage or disadvantage, because the military does things differently. So everybody starts from step one.
Mm-hmm.
But at least, you know, I wasn't afraid of flying or... at least knew some of the things that were going to happen and not happen.
Right. What was it like adapting to the military lifestyle at this basic training?
It was fine. I had no problem with it. You know, I missed the family. My wife was, when I was there, learned that she was expecting a child. And, of course, that was rather hardship, but... you could not, at that time as an aviation cadet, I could not live off base, and she could not be off base. It was permitted, when I had applied for aviation cadet program back in 1948, one of the ground rules, yes, you could be married.
Okay.
And that was a question, that was a decision that was later changed by the military. So when I was notified that I had been accepted for the cadet program, I wrote right back and said, hey, in the meanwhile, guys, I've been married. And they said, no problem. You applied and were accepted under the other regulations. And so you be there when we tell you to.
Right.
So, but others, they're in the training at Perrin, there were probably six, seven of us that were married as aviation cadets, which the regulation had changed, and you could not be a married cadet.
Okay. You said this was a six-month training?
Sorry. Yeah, that was 6 months. That was what they in those days called basic training. From there, you were, depending on your ability and what your instructor thought, your grades in ground school and all these kind of things, you were sent to an advanced training base. At that time, there were two bases that were you trained in the specific types of aircraft that you would fly eventually in your career. Two of them were multi-engine. One of the advanced bases was in Selma, Alabama, was P-51s. And the fourth was at Williams Air Force Base in Arizona, where you qualified in jet aircraft.
Okay, and you went to Williams.
I went to Williams. I was lucky enough to get what I really wanted to do, fly jet airplanes.
Now, you obviously, I guess, scored high enough to get jet airplanes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What? Tell me your basic training at Perrin. Can you describe kind of what you guys did on a daily basis as you progressed? Was it more classroom? Was it a lot of flying?
It was about half a day of class and half a day of being on the flight line.
Okay.
You didn't get to fly every day, but out of the week, you probably flew 3 to 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that during the 6 month time frame, you got perhaps around 120 hours of flying time.
Okay. What was the most challenging aspect of that training for you?
Adjusting to military.
Okay.
You had school always half a day, and mm-hmm. like I say, since none of us, well, I had been military reserve, but most of the folks were just out of civilian life. Most of the cadets were just out of civilian life, so you also had military training to go. You had academic training in aircraft systems and all of this, navigation, radio. You also had military training and marching and picking up things and keeping your room, your barracks in order and all that, just as a regular GI.
Mm-hmm. What was the most difficult as far as that regular GI training, the non-flying part?
Oh, I think...
Or the most
probably
memorable
you had to
part.
March. You had to walk. You had to march, not walk. You had to march everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere you went, there was you were in formation and you marched.
Uh huh. Okay.
Which would sort of aggravate you when you'd see some of the pilot trainees in the class were student officers. They had already graduated either West Point or Annapolis or college ROTC, and of course they were officers. They didn't have to walk.
Right.
So that was.
So tell me about Williams Air Force Base and your advanced training.
Basically the same type of program. You mm-hmm. flew, you got maybe another 120, 25 hours of flying time spread over the 6 month time frame. You went to classes half a day. You mm-hmm. You marched. You lived in the barracks. You were on the flight line learning that end of it the other half of the day.
Okay. What aircraft were you trained in again?
I was, in those days, the first 3 months of your advanced training was in the T-28 aircraft.
Okay.
Which is North American aircraft. Mm-hmm. A little bit bigger than the T-6, a little faster, mm-hmm. More systems, more navigation systems, more just a little advanced trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last 3 months you were there, you transitioned, and if you had passed all so far. And there's always the potential of you being eliminated for failure to maintain proficiency or in grades or military or flying training.
Mm-hmm.
So you, the last 3 months, you graduated then into the T-33/F-80.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was your training is strictly learning to fly the airplane and use the systems in it. There's mm-hmm. nothing to do with the eventual use you're going to get. You go to what they call crew training later on.
Mm-hmm.
During this time frame, my wife had actually moved into Lubbock. Sherman, Texas,
mm-hmm.
at Christmas time. I had Christmas leave of 1950 and came back to Sherman. I couldn't live in town with her. I had to live on the barracks and didn't get to see her too much, but at least she was close by.
Now, is this during basic at Perrin?
Yeah, at Perrin.
Okay.
And then when we moved to, when I was transferred down to Williams, again, as an aviation cadet, you didn't make very much money.
Right.
I think it was $125 a month or something like that. So mm-hmm. She had been working, and So she moved back to Southern California and went back to work, and I was at Perrin until, at Williams, and until, well, it was July 51.
Right.
July 51, I had an airplane wreck in the F-80. I crashed one.
Did you really? What happened?
How it happened, I don't know. What happened, I wound up breaking my back.
Really? You don't know how it happened?
Compression. Well, yes, I stalled on final turn on landing.
Okay.
And it stopped flying and fell to the ground.
Okay.
At that time, the F-80 did not have an injection seat, and I don't know whether I would have made it out of the aircraft if it did have one.
Mm-hmm.
But I hit on the ground. It didn't kill me, but it did break my back. So being then in the hospital for several months, about 3 months, But I continued. I was after about a month, I was able to get back in and at least do the ground school part and continue the program. And I was there was a prognosis of complete recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a compression fracture, lower back, mm-hmm. and so I would go to ground school. I'd take all the military training subjects continue like I was in the program. I just was not flying.
Right. When were you able to get back into the cockpit?
I started flying again in, probably December of that year.
Okay.
And so all I had left to do really was the last 3 months of pilot training.
Mm-hmm. Were you still at Williams or did you go somewhere
else? I was still
at
Williams, yeah.
Okay.
So I had to go back into the T-6 for a bit to get requalified to show the flying people that I could still take off and land an airplane,
mm-hmm.
which I did, and then got back into the jet training and finished the program, finished and graduated as a second lieutenant and a military pilot, and March of 19. That would be 52.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
I went from there. Of course, the Korean War was going on
at
this time. So being jet-qualified single-engine fighter pilot, mm-hmm. I was sent to Luke Air Force Base, the other side of Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
where I went was assigned to a weapons class in... F-80, F-84.
Mm-hmm.
Did a little bit of... No F-80 in there, just F-84.
Okay.
Now, I'm transitioning from the F-80 to F-84, so there's a little time where you learn how to fly the F-84.
Mm-hmm.
But the other... it's about a 3 or 4 month program, so... most of it devoted to using the airplane as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to shoot the guns and drop mm-hmm. bombs and those kind of things.
How did that come to you? Was it difficult?
Oh, not difficult at all. I seemed to get through it okay.
Really? Any memorable incidents that you remember from the training on the F-84?
I don't know that I anything specific. It seemed like, you know, okay, here's a culmination of what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I'm doing it, and life is lovely.
Okay. So how long were you at Luke?
Just about 4 months.
Okay. All right. And then from there, where did you go?
Then Luke was sort of a TDY assignment on the way to... my eventual orders was to Korea.
Okay. And where were you stationed?
I'm sorry?
Where were you stationed in Korea?
I was sent to 49th Fighter Bomber Wing in Daegu,
mm-hmm.
which is south central South Korea, and to a 84 wing, and was involved then from until September time frame up until the end. I left just before the war ended.
Okay.
The program then was you fly 100 combat sorties and your tour is finished.
Right.
You were eligible to extend if you wanted to, but I said, no, I've got a wife and little boy at home that I haven't seen for a long time, so off I went, came back to the home.
How long did it take you to get your 100 missions?
I finished the first part of June, or late May of 1953.
Okay. Tell me about some of the missions that you flew in Korea. What was that like? What was your typical day like? What was your routine?
Oh, typical. Now we're in a truce-type situation. There is a ceasefire in place. But we were still flying combat sorties into North Vietnam and...
North Korea? Yeah.
Disrupting... North Korea.
Right.
Disrupting their flow of traffic, destroying bridges... Sometimes we would fly support of ground forces. There would be a push by the North Vietnamese/Chinese against an American army unit, and we would be called. So you did close air support, as you call it those days, supporting the army. We did interdiction. We did reconnaissance. We flew some night combat missions trying to destroy guns and supplies and things like that.
What was it like?
It was never involved in air-to-air combat.
Okay.
The F-84 was not really used for that.
Did you ever encounter...
F-86s over there doing that.
Right. Did you ever encounter any MiGs?
I saw one once. Way up above me being chased by an F-86. No, I never was subjected to any kind of air-to-air combat.
Okay. How did it feel being in a war zone, being in combat for the first time?
Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes, you got to think of it. Hey, I've got a job to do. I got to destroy. You're not. One thing about being in combat in an aircraft, I've never been in an air-to-air combat situation where I'm trying to shoot down another airplane. It just never happened to me. You are slightly detached. You are not bombing, shooting, killing people. You are bombing, destroying targets. So you don't get that I don't know what you'd call it, a worry or concern that, you know, what's happening on the ground. You really don't think about that. You think, my mission is to destroy a target, whether it be a bridge or a line of trucks down the highway or a factory or whatever. Somebody up above has decided that's your target for the day. You go out and you do your damnedest to try and destroy it.
Okay.
And not thinking that there are individuals on the other end.
And
you're very detached. It's not like sitting over the end of a rifle and pointing your rifle at somebody and say, you know, it's either he or me.
Right.
So you don't get that kind of feeling about it. I never did, anyway. There was an inanimate object that I had to destroy, and that was my job, and I was going to do it. Not thinking that, you know, there's people or other things involved in it. It's an object to destroy.
Yes, sir. Were there any memorable missions that come to mind now when you think back about the Korean War and your experience there that you've seen?
I can't think of any. I did spend a week up on the front lines and observing how airplanes are controlled from the front line with a forward air controller and watched as they called in airplanes to destroy gun positions or whatever like that. And My only thought was, God, I'm glad I'm not up here with these guys. I'm sure glad I'm up flying airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea was colder than all blue blazes during the winter time.
Right.
Besides, they get shot at more. I don't know that they got shot at any more than I did, but it was. I did get shot at. I know I did because I came home sometimes with holes in the airplane. But you never think of it. It's you know.
You didn't think about that.
No.
What did you think of the U.S. conduct in the Korean War and how the war turned out?
Well, I think it drug on for about 3 years, 2 years there. With I think it was justifiable. I think the. It was an invasion, strictly an invasion by North Korea, and
mm-hmm.
later assisted by the Chinese in vast numbers, and I think it was a justified cause. I think the, unfortunately, the last 2 years, the killing and the battles kept going on, but there was never really any change, significant change in the... The final ending, the truce line ended just about where it was when they first declared the truce.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So when you finished in June 53, thereabouts, and you did you transition back to the United States or did you stay in Asia?
No, I came back to the U.S. when you finished your combat tour. You were reassigned back to the States. My assignment back to the U.S. was back to Luke Air Force Base as a weapons instructor.
Okay.
So I flew for the next 3.5 years or so at Luke as a F-84 pilot, teaching young pilots to how to use, as I had gone through, how to use the airplane as a weapon.
Mm-hmm. And you did that for how long?
Oh, I was at Luke until, 55, 56, 50, late 50s, middle 56.
Okay.
So another 3.5 years.
Okay. And from there, where did you go?
I went to Randolph Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
They needed some F-84 type airplanes down at Randolph.
Mm-hmm.
Randolph at that time, being a headquarters base, also had a flying wing where they taught. KC-97 crews how to use the KC-97 as a refueling airplane,
mm-hmm.
as refueling school.
Mm-hmm.
So what they needed was some airplanes that were relatively inexpensive to fly up behind the KC-97,
mm-hmm.
and train the boom operators,
okay.
on how to use the boom refueling system.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I did that for a couple years.
Okay, until by 1958.
Yeah, 58. Summer of 58, the training command of the Air Force, this was all still part of training command of the Air Force, was changing, and those aircraft that were in advanced training, like I was there at the time, not primary, not teaching you how to fly, but teaching how to use a system.
Mm-hmm.
Being given or being transferred to the using commands.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, fighter aircraft tactic training in fighter aircraft would go to tactical air command, training in bomber type aircraft would go to SAC. The KC-97s all at that time basically supported SAC.
Mm-hmm.
So that organization was going to the KC-97 training wing at Randolph was going to SAC.
Okay.
And fighter pilots and SAC don't normally agree.
Right.
Yeah, you know, SAC didn't have fighter airplanes. They
uh-huh.
had bombers. So
uh-huh.
Nobody wanted, none of us that were down there doing this particular thing wanted to go to SAC, so we all looked for ways to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I had tried to do all along, all these years, that from time I got into the Air Force or was able to I would continue taking courses at junior colleges close to where I was stationed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the time came, I said, okay, maybe I have enough credits now to go back to college and get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I had an associate degree. It was all just 2 years of college, mm-hmm. plus other courses. So I applied through the Air Force. I didn't want to get out of the Air Force. I applied through the Air Force for what they called the AFIT, Air Force Institute of Technology program.
Mm-hmm.
That was through a large organization at Wright-Patterson, I guess it was, Air Force Base in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several options if you were accepted into the program, which I was. There were several options depending upon what you selected to be your undergraduate degree. And I said, okay, I will, if possible, mechanical or electrical or aeronautical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Air Force evaluates what you have. Depending then upon what kind of program you want to get into, your transcripts then are forwarded to an associate university or college.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the training is done right at Wright-Patterson.
Okay.
But at that time, most of it, and I assume that program's still going, I don't know. My transcripts were sent to Texas Tech.
Okay.
And they were evaluated by the staff at Texas Tech, and I got a letter back from that Texas Tech told the Air Force, yeah, we could accept him and in a degree of mechanical engineering.
Okay.
So the Air Force sent me a letter and said, you're hereby assigned as of, you know, the fall term to Texas Tech University for an undergraduate study in mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm. When was this?
That was 1958.
Okay.
Summer of 58. So, sure enough, there I was. Had to move my wife, family, and young son. Had a daughter by this time up to Lubbock and
mm-hmm.
Be there for the start of school and August or September, whenever it was,
and did you
enrolled into the program.
Did you complete
the program? We were still in the military,
right.
though those of us that were pilots would were required to go out to Reese Air Force Base. I don't even know if it's there anymore.
It's here, but it's no longer an Air Force Base.
Yeah, okay. That was at that time it was a pilot training base. So those of us, one of the requirements in the Air Force is to get paid. At that time, to get paid, you had to fly 4 hours a month.
Mm-hmm.
So we, of those of us that are in the AFIT program at Texas Tech, were assigned to Reese to get our flying time.
Mm-hmm.
But our primary duty was being a student.
Right.
And we had to meet all the requirements of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not have any military duties, marching or any of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were students. Professional students,
right?
Getting paid by the Air Force, and the Air Force was paying our education, so mm-hmm. that was a neat deal.
Mm-hmm. How long was it? A 4-year program?
It was a 2-year program.
Okay,
because you had to have 2 years of college to get into the AFIT program. I had 2 years when Texas Tech evaluated registrar's office, whoever does that kind of thing, evaluated my transcripts. When I got there, they said, okay, you have 2 years of college, but only a little over a year of it applies to a mechanical engineering degree.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of my courses were in Pasadena City College were termination courses going toward employment.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually wound up needing 3 years of college trying to squeeze it into 2 years.
Okay.
3 years worth of credits.
Right.
To comply with the requirements of tech in getting an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I found after my 2 years was up that I still needed basically another year's worth And so I applied for an extension and was accepted for a one-term extension. So I stayed at Texas Tech, continuing on as a full-time student until, and I was carrying about 20 hours a, you know, a quarter. It wasn't a light load.
That's a heavy load.
Yeah, you know, your social life was absolutely zip. You you studied. The only thing I could remember doing was if there was a football game in town, I would go to the stadium. If there was a basketball game, I would go there. That was my entertainment. I'd take my son with me.
Okay.
I was there when they enlarged the stadium. You've probably heard of that program.
Yes, sir.
Where they slid the thing, whole thing back. Well, that was quite a to get into the Southwest Conference.
And
of course, we were avid supporters of Tech in all sports. So.
What was Texas Tech like at that time period, 58 to 61?
Small. A fall semester was a little over 9,000 students, full load campus.
Okay.
A spring semester maybe dropped down to 6,000.
Okay.
Summer school, which we had to go to, double all classes. I don't know how many were there, but I carried 20 units plus summer school units the entire 2.5 years I was there.
How'd you do academically?
Not too bad. I don't know what my average turned out to be, but I wasn't Sigma Cum Laude, that's
right.
For damn sure, but I graduated, I qualified. When I did leave finally in January of 61, I still was short 12 units.
Okay.
And I made arrangements with Tech to take those either correspondence or at a my next assignment was out in Los Angeles. One of the things that the Air Force required, if they sent you to the school, they demanded that you be used in the field that your studies were in. And that's not being a pilot, that's being a basically, I was in mechanical engineering, so I went to an engineering function. And so made arrangements with Texas Tech to either take correspondence or local university courses out in the Los Angeles area to finish up the 12 units.
Right. Okay.
Which eventually I did. So actually my degree date is 1963.
Okay. What did you do in Los Angeles?
I worked at that time was called Ballistic Missile Division, which was the engineering end of the Air Force that procured ballistic missiles for the military.
Okay.
The Titan, Minuteman, the Atlas program. Those were all under what we called at that time Ballistic Missile Division. Part of Air Material, wasn't Materiel Command, it was Systems Command.
Okay.
So I was in the Minuteman program office working. The Air Force was the managers of the program. The actual engineering acceptance, we did the acceptance. The engineering review and all that was done by an organization called TRW, which was under contract to the Air Force. But we had to know what the heck was going on. I was in a section that we called configuration management, which was in charge of to buy a system, for the military to buy a system, for instance, the Minuteman missile. We are not necessarily buying each missile. We are buying a way to make those missiles. We were buying an engineering program. So it was part of my responsibility to ensure that the drawings, the specifications were all acceptable to do the end job of that piece of paper was to build something that, once you build it and put it with other things that were built, makes a missile.
Right.
So I did that for 3 years.
Did you enjoy that kind of work, or did you miss
it? Well, I was still a pilot, so I still had to fly airplanes to get my flying pay. It was all right, but I my purpose, I think, would be fly airplanes.
Okay.
So I kept bugging my boss to this was a directed out of once you finished your college portion of this AFIT program, you went to 3 years directed duty. My 3 years, every time I had an opportunity, I told my boss that I wanted to get back to flying. And he'd say, don't bug me. You got 3 years.
Right.
So finally, I kept doing it. I wanted to, you know, I didn't particularly care for it. It wasn't that bad. I was home all the time. You know, it was it certainly wasn't an 8 to 6 job, but it was not flying airplanes, which I went in the Air Force to do, so I kept bugging my boss to let me go back to flying, and he said, all right, Merritt, and finally he said, when you have less than 6 months left, I will sign a paper authorizing you to try to get back to flying job.
Okay.
But I did my job. I, you know, I was dutiful, and we the Air Force at that the office I was in at that time developed a operational Minuteman missile system, which is what we were supposed to be doing.
Right.
And that system is the only one still operating. So
yes, sir.
I feel satisfied that I contributed at least to the. To the operations, I don't know that they ever got used. Well, I hope they never get used. But,
right.
You know, it was a deterrent, and that was my function, so I did it.
When did you finish that program? It was 1964?
I left. I finally got the assignment out of... the unit had moved from Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, Air Force Station, out to Norton Air Base, so... I left, I got out of Norton Air Force Base in, early 1964.
Okay.
I got an assignment. My 3 years were almost up. I'd been there, 3 years, and my assignment was to, I requested to go into F-4 pilot training, or F-4 upgrade training. And at that time, the F-4 was still not enough of them around, so I was got orders to go to F-105s.
Okay. And where was that?
That was at Nellis Air Force Base.
Okay.
First of all, I went to survival school up at Stead Air Base.
What was that like?
Oh. Miserable.
Was it a 2 week program?
2 or 3 week. 3 week, I think. It seemed sort of funny that I was going there at the afterthought. I wanted to go, but because I'd never had anything like that going flying. They didn't have that kind of program during the Korean War,
right?
That I knew of. Here I'm sent to Stead Air Force Base in January of 1964. The training, the classroom training and thing is done right there at Stead. It's about 30, 40 miles north of Reno. No longer there either. Then your field exercises, where you go out and be in an EVAD for a while.
Right.
And they try to capture you, and you go through prison training and code of conduct training and all that kind of stuff. Is up in the Sierra, east side of the Sierra Mountains. And, of course, in January, there's snow up to your armpits.
Right.
So I'm going to Southeast Asia. I knew where I was going. You know, I'm going to Okinawa.
Right.
Why am I going to survival school in the middle of winter?
Right.
Well, they didn't have jungle survival school at that time, so mm-hmm. the only thing they had, survival school, which in some respects was all right because part of your survival training is imprisonment.
Yes, sir.
And you get the code of conduct and you get a little bit of what it might like be like in a prison situation.
How much did that help you when you were in Hanoi? How much applied?
Not really a whole lot, because you knew that the instructors could not hurt you.
Right.
You knew that this program, this prison training, compound training exercise is over in 2.5 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know you can not get anything to eat for 2.5 days, and you know you're not going to be hurt, you know you're not going to be starved, nothing's really going to happen to you. It's strictly a simulation, and you hope, let's get out of here. let's finish this thing and get on with go to where I'm really going to go start flying airplanes again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I learned how to, we didn't even have to catch a rabbit on the survival portion of it. They gave us a rabbit and we had to cook it,
mm-hmm.
So that part of it, and then there was nothing to do, trap around in snowshoes and 6 feet of water, snow, and to prepare you for Southeast Asia was not the answer.
Okay.
They later, before I was shot down and I was in Okinawa, they started what they called jungle school there in the Philippine Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a little more aimed at Southeast Asia, but
mm-hmm.
I didn't ever go through that.
Right, right. So when you get to Nellis, how long did your F-105 training?
Oh, that's only a couple months long.
Okay.
You learn again. You're already a pilot. You know how
mm-hmm.
to fly airplanes. You just learn how to fly the particular airplane you're going to school in,
mm-hmm.
and how to use it as a system to drop bombs and fire rockets and all those other things that it does.
Mm-hmm. How different was the 105 from the 84?
Improvements in airplanes. It was
mm-hmm.
Four or five times as fast.
Mm-hmm.
It was four or five times as heavy, and it can carry four or five times as much.
Mm-hmm.
F-84, you struggled to carry 2 1,000-pound bombs. The F-84 can carry up to 16 750-pound bombs.
Or 105, you mean?
Yeah, 105,
right.
I mean. Yeah, 105. Plus now we're in a nuclear age, and you are learning how to deliver those systems,
mm-hmm.
which the F-84 never did.
Right, right.
So it's a huge step forward
mm-hmm.
in technology
mm-hmm.
and capability, and but to operate it, it operates the same way.
Right.
You pull the stick back and it goes up, and you push it down and it goes forward and it goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things. Flying the airplane portion of it is not that much different.
Mm-hmm.
You've got systems that internal operating systems of the airplanes that are different and advanced, and the particular systems of navigation and
mm-hmm.
communications are all far advanced from what you had in the F-84, but again, not that much, because we're not yet into the glass cockpit,
mm-hmm.
so to speak,
mm-hmm.
as airplanes have today. Everything's on a visual display.
Mm-hmm.
You had gauges and you had instruments.
Right. So after you finished your training, is that when you went over to Kadena?
I left in the summer of 64, or late spring of 64, and was assigned to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
got there and lived in the BOQ for a while until we found quarters on the island for my wife and family to join me.
Okay, so they were able to come over.
Oh, yeah, they were there. They got there probably about 2 months after I was there.
Okay.
So, early fall of 64, they arrived on the island. We had a little small house off base, later moving to on base quarters.
Mm-hmm. What were your duties there, Kadena?
I was a flight commander. A squadron commander, operations officer, and usually a fighter squadron has four flights of 8 to 10 pilots, and you're responsible for their training and their flying and making sure that they're doing what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in actually, probably as a flying job, it's your first command responsibility. You're responsible for 8 to 10 people underneath you.
Mm-hmm. What was your rank at this time?
When I got to Okinawa, I was captain.
Okay.
I was promoted. That was spring of early summer of 64, December of 64. I was promoted to major.
Okay. All right. Why don't we take a break, sir?
Okay.
Okay, sir, let me ask you, this is 1964, you're in Okinawa, you're over in Southeast Asia. What did you know about why the United States was actually involved in Southeast Asia and Vietnam specifically at this point in your career?
At this point, I knew that we had advisors, Army advisors, down in Southeast Asia, in the southern part of Vietnam. I knew that the country had was divided. I knew, but the operations that were going on, I don't think anybody thought that much about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you know what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam? Why they were there?
Other than support the South Vietnamese government, which couldn't seem to keep a president.
Right. That was quite a tumultuous time period right there.
Oh, yeah. They were having coups and all kinds of things going on. But, you know, it was, excuse me, at that time, our primary concern where I was in Okinawa and what I was doing was certainly, excuse me, I'm kind of tickled here, was certainly not Southeast Asia. It was China.
Right.
So, and our mission primarily was aimed in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Southeast Asia was, a blip down there. You'd hear about it. Didn't seem to be that much going on that we knew of.
Mm-hmm. What were your orders or your duties specific to the China threat there in Okinawa?
Well, we were part of a deterrence to keep China in bay.
Mm-hmm.
We had aircraft on alert. Same as SAC, Strategic Air Command, did to attack targets if necessary, if ordered.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
On the mainland.
How long were you going to be stationed in Okinawa? What was your
normal tour? Like that was 3 years.
Okay, so you knew you'd be there into 1967.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you get to fly any at all into South Vietnam at this point?
Okay, let's, I got there in early May of 64.
Mm-hmm.
I was assigned to a squadron. I was a flight commander.
Sir.
My wife and children, whose number is increased by this time, arrived probably in July, August time frame. We had a house off base. We were, as a main part of our mission at that time, mid-64 time frame, was the alert business of deterrence against against China.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't hear that much what's going on down Southeast Asia, other than, you know, reports. We were not involved in any fighting going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We knew there were airplanes down there, but again, part of their mission was some F-100s were stationed at Clark Air Base, I guess. Again, they were primarily deterrence against China.
Mm-hmm.
November of 1964,
mm-hmm.
our squadron was tasked to send, I think, 10, maybe 8 airplanes to Da Nang Air Base,
mm-hmm.
as on a trial basis to see if the 105 could be adapted and used in Southeast Asia. We did not, that's what we did. I was in the squadron, squadron commander selected me because I had experience in, war experience in the F-84, which is basically the same mission.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been a weapons instructor, so I was the senior flight commander, so my flight and the squadron commander took 8 airplanes to Da Nang Air Base.
Okay. How long were you there?
We were only there about 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
as I recall. We did not fly any combat,
mm-hmm.
Per se. One time we did, I can remember going over into the Laotian area,
mm-hmm.
to act as, quote unquote, cover for some MiG cover in case the MiGs came down from North Vietnam or even China, wherever they might come from, against some Laotian, quote unquote, fighters, bombers doing some bombing work in Laos.
Okay.
Which at that time, that was nothing much was said about that.
Right.
It was I don't even know if the American public knew we were that. Of course, they were probably the pilots that were there were Laotian pilots, probably Air America and. Doing the training of the Laotians.
Mm-hmm.
That's as close to combat. We just sort of stood up and watched what they were flying overhead, watching what they were doing and being listening for alerts for any MiGs coming down. There certainly wasn't any threat to us,
mm-hmm.
Unless the MiGs did perhaps come down out of wherever they were going to come from.
What were they doing on the planes that you were watching in Laos?
Well, they were dropping small bombs, T-20. They were flying T-28 aircraft, and that doesn't carry too many bombs.
Right.
But they were attacking probably the Pathet Lao, there in some positions in the southern part of Laos.
Okay. Had you received any instruction at this point of what happened if you would get shot down over Vietnam or Laos?
No, not. Not specifically.
Okay. Nothing beyond your survival.
Not on this first trip down
here.
No. Like I say, we were down there about 2 weeks, and we flew home, and nothing more was thought about it.
Okay. What was your impression of Vietnam at that time?
a lot of trees. we did get off. A bunch of us went over into downtown, into the. The commercial part of Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
but it sort of seemed strange that all the buses had wire screen, heavy wire screen over the windows.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, watch out! Somebody might try to throw a hand grenade in the window,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. But we didn't see any visual sign. Other than that, we didn't see any visual signs of any kind of harassment by Viet Cong or whatever you want to call them, South Vietnamese uprising type thing going on. Now, there was more of that going on down in the Saigon area.
Right.
And I never got to Saigon. Never was down in that area.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah, you knew there was some threat. Remember now this time frame, the Marines Marines have not arrived.
The Gulf of Tonkin happened, and then...
The Gulf of Tonkin had happened, yeah, and
right.
I think that's what led to us going down, you know, what's going to... And, of course, at that time, the only news we had was what the government had put out and the press, you know, torpedo boats that attacked the destroyer. And we had no reason to disbelieve that. Anyway, we went down there. They finally, whatever reason, our little experiment into seeing how the 105 would fit into the program did or didn't work. I don't know. But we never. After that, the F-105 was never used in. Never, that to my knowledge, used in Southeast. Or South Vietnam. We continued our Okinawa mission until sometime in, late January, I guess. Middle of March. When we had some orders sending our squadron, since we had been down there first, our squadron went to an air base in Thailand.
Okay.
Koh Rat.
What was your mission there?
To set up operations specifically to prepare for flying over North Vietnam.
Okay.
We were there probably less than a week when we weren't flying, at that time we weren't flying into North Vietnam, or we weren't even flying into Laos. We were just flying missions around Thailand, seeing where we were, getting the lay of the land around there. We did get orders, or as they say, fragmentation orders, to get ready to fly a mission against a target in North Vietnam. With F-105s. It was going to be a combined mission. There were going to be other aircraft that were flying up there against the same target from South Vietnam as well as ours, the F-105s. This was late February. We were to be this was going to be the first U.S. Air Force mission into North Vietnam.
Okay.
You know, the Navy had been in there for the Tonkin Gulf thing, but other than that, there had been no attack mission attack missions against North Vietnam by U.S. Air Force aircraft.
Right.
There may have been reconnaissance, or there may have been other things, but as far as dropping bombs and trying to destroy a target, none. We briefed for this mission. It was a so-called the target definition description was an ordnance depot, and it was some short distance, 20, 30 miles north of the DMZ. Of course, we had all this stuff laid out on our map, where the DMZ was, where we could fly, where we couldn't fly. It was very, very tight control into what you could or could not do if and when we went into North Vietnam. We briefed for this mission. We went out in the airplanes, sat basically a cockpit alert with all the things on, ready to push the button to start. For about 2 hours, sometime 2 hours plus, waiting for a release to go mm-hmm. against this target. It never came that day. Finally, we were called back in, said, okay, mission's canceled. Brief, same mission tomorrow, same time, same station type thing. We did this the second day. We sat in the airplanes and waited to release, and nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
We were called back to the briefing ship.
Mm-hmm.
Your mission scrubbed. And I don't remember right now whether it was third day or the fourth day, but this kept going on. You know, what's going on?
Right.
What's going on? Why are we being held up? Finally, on either the third or fourth day, we got released to take off and go bomb this target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finally, we're doing something.
Right.
Why are we doing it? We don't know, other than the fact that, you know, the Tonkin Gulf thing, and we knew that the North Vietnamese were helping the so-called Viet Cong in South Vietnam in their efforts to overthrow the South Vietnamese government, and our mission was to support the South Vietnamese government.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember those in that briefing, the restrictions that were given to you, or kind of how you would, your fire discipline, things like that?
I don't remember any specifics. We had targets, and we had sequences, and I don't recall any of the details of what would happen if you were shot down or anything else or like this. You know,
what about air defenses around Hanoi?
We knew there were going to be air defenses. In fact, I was involved. I was my flight of airplanes. Four aircraft. I was again flying with the wing commander, or the squadron commander, and the first aircrafts that crossed the target. There were multiple aircraft. There were F-100s from South Vietnam, probably Da Nang. There were B-57s, American B-57s from South Vietnam, probably further south. I don't remember right now where they were stationed, but down closer to Saigon. There were F-105s, probably rescue airplanes in and about, SAR forces.
Yes, sir.
Probably out of Nakhon Phanom, just inside the Thai border. Now, also at this time, we were cautioned against saying that we were using Thai air bases. That was still something going on between the U.S. government and the Thai government, the monarchy, saying, you know, oh, we don't want the world to know you're using our air bases to bomb North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, where'd you come from? Well, I don't know.
Right. Somewhere south.
What do you say?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the first four aircraft of F-100s were first across the target with flak, what they call flak suppression, dropping CBUs, cluster bomb units, to anti-personnel weapons, little teeny bomblets. Our first four aircraft, the flight that I was in, and I was number three man, our first four aircraft from our squadron was across the target. Same thing, CBUs. Okay, we were circling the target, waiting for the, or not circling, just waiting, getting in position to make our attack. We saw the F-100s go across and drop their bombs, bomblets. Did one of them get shot? I think one of the F-100s got shot down. Now, to deliver CBUs, cluster bomb units, anti-personnel, it's a low-level, high-speed pass across the target. I mean, down 100-300 feet.
Right.
We were warned that there were automatic weapons up to medium density, 57-millimeter anti-aircraft weapons around this particular target. And it was a very easy target to see, a lot of few buildings and a lot of boxes and things like that standing around, and it was designated an ordnance supply point.
Mm-hmm.
First four airplanes, F-100s, went across, and one of them, as I recall, was shot down. Okay, that sort of delayed us while we tried to figure out, you know, where he went. Was he going to be able to be rescued? Did we have to go over and help the rescue rather than continue the bombing mission?
Mm-hmm.
Finally, it was determined. Right now I can't recall what it was. But there was an F-100 shot down, and I later find out that the pilot was captured and was a prisoner, first Air Force prisoner.
Okay.
Our airplane, our four airplanes went across the target in the release formation, and our number two airplane was hit with small arms, automatic weapons type fire.
Mm-hmm.
We continued releasing our weapons. Now, the weapon that we had was CBU. I think it was CBU-12s. It doesn't matter. It's a little bomblet that comes out of a canister, and it has a parachute.
Mm-hmm.
And it floats down, and as it hits the ground, it explodes. It has a trigger device that explodes it. And they're not very big, maybe a size of a softball.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody forgot to take into consideration that there were a lot of trees around this place.
Mm.
So as we went across, we could see little white parachutes all over hanging in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
These little bomblets had not gone down and had not exploded.
Mm-hmm.
So we were carrying the same thing, so basically the same thing happened. It was, it was an ineffective weapon under the circumstances because they weren't going off. They weren't killing anybody like they were supposed to. What anti-suppressant does is you try to kill the gunners
mm-hmm.
that are shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't doing it. So we had the F-100s had an airplane shot down. We had an airplane shot down. Our pilot got further away. The number two guy got further away from the target area than did the F-100 pilot. He was eventually rescued, but for all practical purposes, that stopped our portion of the mission for a while. We were done. We were headed back anyway, but
mm-hmm.
we went out and covered for our downed pilot,
mm-hmm.
And he was picked up.
Okay.
So, here now, out of eight airplanes across the target, two of them are shot down. You know, that's not too good.
No.
What's going on? What eventual damage we did, we never did rebomb that target. I don't recall what the bomb damage assessment was afterwards, but we flew back. Our airplanes flew back. All the rest of them got back. We probably had 16 airplanes total.
Mm-hmm.
And we all got back to Karat Air Base, and our rescued pilot got brought back, and we had a big party. You know, everything's
mm-hmm.
all right.
Mm-hmm.
Rescue forces work good.
Mm-hmm. And this is your first mission.
Yeah, first mission.
Right.
Two airplanes that we know of got shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And and we didn't know that the one pilot had been captured. We just knew we had lost a pilot and
mm-hmm.
two airplanes out of
mm-hmm.
out of the mission. Probably I don't know how many total airplanes there were, but like I say, from Karat 16 probably.
Mm-hmm.
So you're down a little bit about that. And did we really do anything? And I don't remember. I just don't remember whether that target was ever destroyed or made inoperable. But it was basically, it's supposed to be a ammunition storage depot.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you felt after your first mission flying into North Vietnam, what this was like?
Oh, no. You know, I had done that in another war.
Right. Know,
basically the same, doing the same thing, basically, using
mm-hmm.
basically the same weapons, CBUs and bombs, just doing it faster and...
mm-hmm.
and probably a greater defense. Mm-hmm. You know, now we've been over, the U.S. military has been in North Vietnam twice, and we've lost at least three airplanes,
mm-hmm.
and resulting in two pilots being prisoners of war.
Now, was your unit permanently stationed, moved over to Korat, or was this a temporary
No, we
duty?
Were down there at TDY.
Okay.
Okay, now, initially, for all the time I was there, Korat, Okinawa's main primary mission was deterrence in China. We would rotate a squadron to Korat for 2 months.
Okay.
So a squadron of airplanes, 18 to 20, would go to Korat,
mm-hmm.
or 24, would go to Korat. We would stay for 2 months, fly missions, and then return to Okinawa for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Three missions, three squadrons. Okay. To fulfill the commitment that we had at Okinawa, a rotational squadron from stateside would fly from wherever they were in U.S., George Air Force Base or McConnell Air Force Base, fly to Okinawa and fill in for the deployed squadron from that base.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we would take some of their pilots with us and maybe a couple of their airplanes instead of our own airplanes. So,
mm-hmm.
But we always then had the three squadrons on duty at Okinawa,
mm-hmm.
the fourth squadron, the rotational squadron, in and out of. So we would go down for 2 months, back to Okinawa for 4 months, down to Korat for 2 months.
Okay.
The second F-105, there was another wing of F-105s in China.
Mm-hmm.
Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yokota. They were doing the same thing. They would have one squadron at, let's say we were at Korat, they were at Tok Li.
Mm-hmm.
With a fill-in squadron coming from one of the other 105 bases, two 105 bases in the States, and they would be down there first. So we had actually temporary duty in Thailand flying to fly combat sorties into North Vietnam,
mm-hmm. okay.
which started, like I say, for the 105, the 2nd of March 1965,
mm-hmm.
finally.
Right.
We never did read or understand what the full story was behind the day-to-day delay on launching that first mission, and it wasn't until many years later and a couple books later that, basically we were waiting for the president to say, okay, let's do it.
Right.
We got very high-level control. On any sortie into North Vietnam.
How long did that last?
I
guess the whole time you were there?
Yeah, it got a little first couple months, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We eventually, the system, or the what we called Rolling Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first of the Rolling Thunder missions into North Vietnam. They were designed, their purpose was to apply pressure up to a point,
mm-hmm.
without getting involved into a full go-to-hell war.
Mm-hmm.
Target Rolling Thunder is primarily against transportation means between North Vietnam and South Vietnam. What we were trying to do was stop the flow of goods to South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling Thunder, and this was eventually approved by LBJ, and that was how we operated for
mm-hmm.
the first long time.
Were you frustrated with that?
Yeah.
When you found out later, or I guess at the time?
Well, at the time, yes, because you couldn't. There are ways to stop a war, and there are ways not to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You don't piddly bomb use multi-million dollar airplanes and weapon systems to bomb trucks on a trail, which was basically what we were limited to. There were, as we would, there were rules of engagement, ROEs, which means it defined what you could attack, where you could attack, and what it took to attack a target once you were cleared to attack it. And there was multi-layers of command all the way up to the White House, as I you know, now know. So unless the White House said go, you could have a target that again restricted areas, restricted locations, restricted ordnance as to where you could and couldn't bomb. Stupid way to run a war. I think I said that in my paper. We could not, and at first there were not surface, North Vietnam did not have surface-to-air missiles, at least in the area where we were allowed to go. You could not attack, one of the ROEs was you were forbidden to attack a SAM site unless it launched a missile in an American airplane. You could watch it being built. You could see it being built. A very distinctive pattern on the ground as it's being built, a Star of David type thing with missiles in the points of the stars and a big radar set right in the middle of it, SA-2s, SA-3s. You could see it being built. You could not attack it. If it launched a missile finally and became operational, the missile site, the SAM site, then it could be targeted. But by now, it's ringed with many layers of automatic weapons, camouflaged, and you know, much more difficult target to find and destroy.
And this was part of your ROE while you were there at Korat?
Yes.
Okay.
And another restriction, of course, you couldn't go within so many miles of the DMZ. You couldn't go within... I think 20 miles, maybe 10, a distance from the Chinese border. You could not, you had a 30-mile circle around Hanoi. You could not fly inside of or drop bombs, expend ordnance inside of. You could not, same thing, Haiphong, the harbor where all the ships were coming into. You could not attack. You could not destroy their capability to conduct the war. You know, you can get targeted for piddly ass things like truck convoys up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and that kind of stuff. But we didn't know at that time how extensive that was. But again, there were severe limitations on what we could and couldn't do from highest level.
Did that affect the morale of the men in your unit?
I think we all said, what the hell, you know, why are we doing this if you can't, if you're not out to win it, why fight it?
So. How much did the shoot down, or those two planes shot down on your first mission, and although one pilot came back, how much was that a factor in morale?
I don't think it was, you know, you sort of expect to lose. I think the biggest effect was the fact that the ordnance we were using to suppress what eventually got these two aircrafts was basically worthless. That was more of a morale problem than the fact that you lose somebody. We, of course, we were ecstatic that that our pilot happened to get picked up. And, by, of course, by now, also, we knew that the man, the Navy pilot that was shot down in the Tonkin Ghost thing had been captured as and alive. So, you know, okay, they're gonna have prisoners, yes. You sometimes expect that in flying airplanes. You get shot down.
Right.
The greatest number of prisoners in World War II were air crews. But again, now we're talking, instead of a B-17 or B-24 with 10 people, we're talking about one person,
mm-hmm.
or two in F-4s.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's there in the back of your mind, but a fighter pilot or a pilot doesn't think that way. He thinks, you know, I'm invincible. Nothing will get me.
Mm-hmm.
I will be home for dinner.
Mm-hmm. I guess you have to.
You have to do that, or what, you know, you lose all purpose of doing your mission.
Right.
Okay. So I'm down there. I'm down in Southeast Asia, and we get a few of these piddly targets here and there
mm-hmm.
until I'm back in, go back to Okinawa. I'm back on the alert pads up there doing my job in Okinawa and listening to what's going on down in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the same thing. I go back down again now after 4 months, and a little less restrictions, but Rolling Thunder has gotten a lot more open. But again,
mm-hmm.
we're restricted, can't go in and around Hanoi or Haiphong. Again, we still can't attack SAM sites until it launches something at American. And we're trying to bomb the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to stop the flow of goods coming south. All right, I'm up to 12th of September.
Is this the shoot-down 16th mission?
16th of September.
Okay. Is this the shoot-down mission?
Yeah, and I've accumulated on the two different times now, the second different time that I've been there, I've accumulated, I think there's 28 combat sorties into North Vietnam.
How close had you been fired upon?
I've seen it. I've gotten a couple bullet holes, but no serious damage.
Any SAM problems?
No SAM problems at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They're not widespread as they later became.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems if we flew a large number of airplanes against the target, whatever that target happened to be. The 105 at that time did not have what we call a RAW system, a device for pinpointing or locating or knowing that SAMs were in the air searching, or not in the air, but the radar was on.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have anti-SAM systems in the 105s.
Mm-hmm.
If we were going into an area where we knew there were SAMs, then we would be assigned a Navy or a Marine airplane that had that kind of equipment on.
Okay.
Our airplanes were being recycled through a modification program to get that equipment put on,
mm-hmm.
put in, but up till the time I was shot down, I never did fly with what we call RAW system, radar
mm-hmm.
homing and detection,
mm-hmm.
and warning, radar homing and warning system.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have it. We did the best we could without it. If we thought we really needed it, we had additional help come in to fly with us.
Mm-hmm. Had you just spoken with your wife about the possibilities and what would happen and that whole scenario if you did get shot down?
Yeah, briefly, you say, you know, the possibility is there. The Air Force is going to look after you.
Mm-hmm.
You won't know. We won't know what's happened to me for a while. I think the wife of a military pilot, combat pilot,
mm-hmm.
Is tenuous at best. But again, if she stayed with you, then she accepts those conditions. Maybe not readily, but it's a fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why there's so much divorce in military pilots' fraternity. I don't know.
Right. Sir, let's pause for a moment.
Okay.